You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yuen.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Amran Gawani to talk about his debut novel, the financial thriller Leverage. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon member, you can access to our members-only Discord server. Where you can chat with us and fellow book club members about all sorts of things, including our monthly book club picks in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. Our next patron's choice is going to be our October pick. So if you join now, you actually get the chance to help us pick next month's book club pick.
Yeah, so we talked to Amran Gawani, who is the author of Leverage, as we previously mentioned, and it is a financial thriller about pretty much a rising star at a hedge fund company who falls from grace and loses $300 million in a day. No big deal. And then gets threatened by his boss to make it all back within 3 months. Otherwise, he's going to blame him for insider trading and for being a terrorist. So big stakes. And we talked about, you know, just the evil world of capitalism and corruption and what it means to be a person of color in an industry that is run by powerful white men. So I hope you guys enjoy this talk with Amran.
Yeah, and before we get to our author chat, just want to give a quick content warning. Amran's book, Leverage, being a satire, as well as taking place in the high-intensity world of finance, does contain quite a bit of gallows humor, specifically through its main character, who is under immense pressure as well as anxiety throughout the story and kind of uses suicidal ideation to cope with that. So we do discuss these themes with Amran during our author chat. So if you are sensitive to this topic, please proceed with caution and also check out our show notes where we will be sharing the time codes of the segment where we discuss these themes. But yeah, with that said, please enjoy our author chat with Amran Gawani.
And we are here with Amran Gawani, writer, content creator, and former Wall Street analyst. And we're here to discuss his debut novel, Leverage. Welcome to the show, Amran.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, so we'd like to start our conversations with a little icebreaker. So I thought this would be pretty fun. What is your favorite, quote, rich people are terrible media? So it can be like a TV show, a book, a movie.
Yeah, it's a little obvious, I guess, but I'll go with Succession. Succession is pretty legendary. I don't watch a lot of TV. I try to stick to a very select few like prestige TV shows, like things that are critically acclaimed and there's a consensus view that you should watch this. And I do think Succession is one of the best shows ever made, and really funny, but also thematically very rich, and you know, pun intended there, because the rich people do the worst things.
So. Yeah, Succession is definitely one of my top favorite shows. It's one of those shows where it's a lot funnier than you would think it would be, especially with like how cinematically everything is shot. It's not like Schitt's Creek or Arrested Development, where it's like very clearly shot like a sitcom and has like over the top humor.
Yeah, yeah, Succession. I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's got that HBO magic, but it is a very darkly funny show. And I did actually, when I queried literary agents looking for representation, I used Succession as a comp in my query letter. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. Your book, your debut has a lot of, you know, common touch points. There are terrible rich people making morally dubious deals and also fail sons, which, you know, it's always fun to read about. Until you remember that they exist in real life.
Yeah, that's basically the story of America.
Yeah, I feel like rich people are terrible is definitely a theme that we've been seeing in American literature for a very long time. I mean, you have The Great Gatsby, you have The Jungle, like you have like history, pretty much, like the Gilded Age and like the 1920s. It's like, of course, this theme is going to be reoccurring in literature as we go through it. So I'm really excited to talk to you about your debut. But before we start, you had some career pivots. You studied chemistry and then worked in finance as an analyst. And now you're an author. That's quite a leap. What made you want to go into writing?
Yeah, it's an obvious and great question. You know, my stock line is midlife crisis. But my more thorough answer is just, you know, traversing this long winding route of trying lots of different stuff and not really liking any of it. And then I think kind of coming to the realization that, you know, I think I'm a creative person inside and that none of those jobs, even chemistry, and then, you know, the work in the pharmaceutical industry, getting an MBA, working in an investment bank, like none of them really satisfied, I think, the creative itch I had. And so when I got to this stage in middle life where, you know, I had a wife and one child and another child on the way, and I kind of became a stay-at-home dad. And when I became a stay-at-home dad, I had this free time all of a sudden that I hadn't had basically in, you know, 15 plus years. And I started to kick around writing. And I was, I always loved to write inside. I was going back to when I was in high school, I liked to write. I wrote for my school newspaper. You know, I always had a journalistic interest, but I kind of knew better being a person of modest means to take a bunch of student loans and then go get a journalism degree. So I guess I always had some financial acumen as well. And but yeah, I like to write. I blogged a little bit in the kind of, you know, mid-2000s, and I wrote for my school newspaper during my MBA program. They actually had like a little satirical newspaper, so I wrote that. And so, yeah, I think it was always in me, and it just finally got to a place where I could develop it and nurture it and bring it out.
Wow, a satirical column in your like MBA program. That is great practice for your novel. I am curious, like, even though this is your debut novel, it doesn't always mean that it's the first manuscript that you work on. Did you have something in the drawer already, or was Leverage the first piece?
No, definitely. So when my midlife crisis started in like late 2018, I just started clicking away at a story, and I joke that the book's not any good. I don't even know if it's any good. I've never reread it. What I do know is that it wasn't a good novel. It was probably a pretty good polemic, like just as a rage typing about the pharmaceutical industry and Wall Street and insider trading and corporate corruption. I think there's a lot of really good stuff in the pages, but it wasn't a good novel. It was too long. It had too many characters. It didn't have the right POV probably. And so, you know, but that's, I consider that first attempt at writing a story kind of like my MFA program. Like I had to learn the craft of fiction writing, and, you know, like anything in life, you know, you learn by doing. And so I was working on that. I worked on that project for about 2 years. You know, most of it was completed during the pandemic, although I don't consider it a pandemic novel because I started it pre-pandemic. I just happened to, you know, finish it during the pandemic. And I don't think, like I said, I don't think it's super bad or anything, but it wasn't where it needs to be to get traditionally published. And so after I took that one out to try to get literary agents and basically went 0-4, then I said, you know, there's something clearly wrong with this manuscript, but at the same time, I really loved the process of writing this book. And so my wife at that point was like, you know, is your midlife crisis over? Or are you ready to go get a real job again? And I was like, nah. And so then I started writing Leverage, and with Leverage, you know, everything kind of clicked. I think I learned a lot from my first manuscript that I worked on that went nowhere. I made some of those structural changes. You know, I made it, the protagonist was more like me, so it was a little easier to kind of capture what that person might be feeling and going through. I put it in first person, and I really leaned into the comedy, and I made the pacing just relentless. Like the book just never slows down, and that's something that I knew I needed to do. Yeah, if I wanted to kind of get an agent in that kind of thriller commercial fiction space, was really streamline the story and, you know, make it shorter and then make it really, really move. And so I was able to luckily, you know, put all that together and then hook some agents and get a deal.
Yeah, I feel it makes sense that you wrote for a satirical newspaper for your MBA program, because as someone who also went through business school shortly after the financial crisis, I feel like until you really study business and how business decisions are made, how numbers are actually used, and what actually goes into the data that people use, I feel like it's hard to understand just how much all of that is ripe for satire. Like, just how much is like made up or based on vibes, and how much people take those vibes very, very seriously.
No, totally. And, you know, there's probably something wrong with my brain wiring. I mean, I've always been a satirical guy by nature. I've always been kind of a smartass and someone who cracks jokes and inappropriate jokes and dark jokes in particular. It's kind of the nature of my personality. And so that obviously lends itself to satirical writing. So before I even thought of, even conjured the idea of ever writing a novel, I was still the kind of guy that would write a short form satire piece and just and email it to my friends. You know, here's just something funny I thought of. And so, like I said, that kind of innate skill was always there. And then I learned how to kind of develop it, you know, for a proper full manuscript. But like, to your point, Marvin, I mean, when I got in the world of business, I was like, you know, man, you just couldn't make any of this up. And I don't want to put myself on a pedestal that I don't deserve to be on. But my favorite book, or certainly the book that's most influential on me, is Catch-22. And I was like, can I do Catch-22 in the world of corporate America? Like, that was basically what I was trying to do with even the first manuscript I worked on. And then even more in particular in Leverage, like, I really was like leaning into just how chaotic can you make this? Because at the end of the day, there's nothing that I could write that's more insane than what's happening in the real world.
I was just going to ask you that, like, in your opinion, like, how challenging is it to write a satirical novel about finance and corruption when we live in a timeline where, like, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Donald Trump exist? It's just like they're pretty much supervillains, but in real life. So, like, were there parts when you were writing your book where you're like, I should reel this back? And then you're like, no, actually, let's go full speed.
You know, totally. And what's really funny about that is when I was first writing the book, I was like, is it even realistic that he would lose $300 million in a single day? And I'm like, you know, that's a lot. And then you just look at the news and then you're like, you know, Wirecard was this company in Germany that was, I think it was $25 billion market cap. The whole thing was a house of cards, just completely made up, went from, you know, one to zero. Warren Buffett, who, you know, is one of the good guys of finance, allegedly. I mean, I don't think there's any good guys in that ecosystem personally, but, you know, he's ostensibly a good guy who, like, you know, has good values. And he bought $1 billion of Activision stock about a month before it was acquired by Microsoft. And who's his buddy? Bill Gates, you know, guy who knows Microsoft inside out. I'm not claiming, just to be clear, that they did anything wrong, but, you know, I mean, $1 billion bet 1 month before a deal. I mean, once I saw that headline, I was like, all bets are off. Like, I can do whatever I want. There's nothing that it couldn't be believable. And then, of course, now, you know, here we are 10 years later. And I set the novel in 2015 for basically three key reasons. One, I didn't want to write about Trump. Two, I didn't want to write about the pandemic. And, you know, three, I had specific experience in Wall Street at that time. So I knew I could be very accurate. And technology has changed quite a bit. And so, especially in the hedge fund industry, which is more automated and algorithmic now than it was even at the time. So those are kind of the three main reasons that I set the novel in that period. But if you look at the headlines now here in 2025, you know, I mean, I just yesterday, or, you know, whenever people listen to this, you know, Oracle had a huge jump in the stock market on this whole AI hype cycle. And this company stock jumped 35%. And I heard that Larry Ellison, you know, the largest shareholder and founder of the company, his net wealth increased by $100 billion in one day. $100 billion in one day. So, I mean, it's, at this point, it's like nothing is too absurd. And I mean, and again, I don't want to get on my soapbox too early in the podcast, but, you know, that's a grotesque, grotesque culture we live in. And so I think, you know, when I wrote Leverage, I was like, how can I make this as, you know, in your face as possible so that there's no ambiguity about what we're doing here?
Just hearing you talk, I can, like, it seems like even though writing is very, like, creative and, like, free-flowing, like, you have a very analytical side. You have you were giving examples of, like, other books that you studied, like Catch-22, and it really seems like you kind of understood the craft, the structure, and also how the business works. Like, did you approach your writing that way as well, or was it more like you figured everything out after you wrote your manuscript?
Yeah, I mean, I think broadly speaking, I mean, I consider myself a scientist at heart. You know, that's why I went into chemistry way back when. But I think maybe I would broaden that lens out to just analyst. Like, I like to study things and learn them, and I'm my lifelong student. And so you know, I was a pretty good chemistry graduate student, even though I didn't pursue that path because, you know, I did a lot of research and I studied things and I really thought about the principles at play and, you know, how to synthesize molecules. And then when I said, hey, you know, this isn't for me, and I went to get an MBA, I went to Carnegie Mellon, which is like, you know, one of the top, you know, quantitative and tech schools. And I like really thought hard about like, okay, valuation is a kind of intrinsically ludicrous thing, but like, what are the actual principles underlying it? And so, yeah, I thought about very analytically about that. And when I worked in the investment bank, I think I was definitely more of a quantitative guy in terms of even the way I thought about, you know, ultimately what's a business of just built on supply and demand and hype and bulls and bears. And it's not as mathematical as people realize, but, you know, but you can bring a very analytical lens to it. And so, you know, I think that just kind of continued as I thought about the craft of writing. Like when I first wrote, like I said, the book that didn't go anywhere, I probably wasn't being analytical enough. I was probably just relying on, you know, hey, I have some creativity and I have a way with words and I'm a pretty funny guy and I can just make this work. And then when it didn't work, I was like, okay, well, let me now put my analysis hat on, which is I should have done in the first place, and said, okay, well, what I really did is I studied the business of publishing to then think about how to improve my craft. So like I said, my first book was way too long. It was like 115,000 words.
Oh, wow, that's long.
It's too long, especially for a contemporary fiction. It's not even outrageously long, but it's too long for the genre. And so I was like, okay, so let me fix that. So then when I finished Leverage, the first draft was only 72,000. When I thought about, you know, the POV considerations, I did kind of a third person omniscient when I did my first novel. And I was like, you know, it's a little divorced. You don't really understand the characters as deeply as you need. I probably understood some of the bit characters better than the protagonist. And so I said, well, let me go into the first person POV, because then we have to be in the head of the narrator. And that gives me a lot of opportunity for him to kind of toss out his macro aggressions while he's also propelling the plot. And so anyway, so, you know, I think that's a long answer to your question that yeah, I mean, I do bring an analytical mindset to basically everything that I do. And I think that, you know, gives me a little bit of an advantage when I tackle projects.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like people forget that publishing is a business and word count and also just like marketing. Everything is so even with just like how books get selected, it's so calculated. So I think it's very interesting as like you, as someone who is not originally from the creative writing space or the English department, you like came in with that mindset and that helped you. And that was like a boon to your writing career. So that's really interesting to hear your experience.
No, I appreciate that. And I like one of the examples that I give people, because I mean, it is a stereotype, but it's kind of alarmingly accurate that a lot of writers are not very business savvy and they are kind of don't want to accept that publishing is ultimately a business. And so, you know, if you just reduce it down to its nuts and bolts, you know, a book is just like a widget and you're trying to make the widget as cheap as possible and then sell the widget for as much money as possible. And just capitalism 101 there. And I think one of the kind of more obvious learnings that I had to learn the hard way was that the reason word count matters is because the book is longer and you have to print more pages, and more pages means more money, and more money means, you know, higher cost of goods and lower profit margin for the publisher. So it's like, oh, right, that's pretty obvious. Like, you don't write a long book because they don't want to print more paper, which is, you know, has gotten substantially more expensive during the pandemic years, especially as inflation has kind of stayed stubbornly high.
Yeah, if you're not going to write the next Game of Thrones, then it's like your book better be under 100,000 words.
Absolutely.
Okay, so, you know, tell us about your book. So for listeners who aren't familiar with your debut novel, Leverage, can you give us a brief, you know, synopsis of what your book is about?
Yeah. So the story revolves around a rising star analyst inside the world's most prestigious hedge fund, Prism Capital. And our hero, or anti-hero, depending on your perspective, is his name's Ali Jafar, and he goes by Al. So he's very not so subtly based off of me. He's a mixed race guy, half Pakistani, half Caucasian, and he's kind of like the ultimate outsider in the ultimate insider's world. And so he is a rising star and hotshot at his fund. He's the top performing guy, and then a market crash happens, which is, you know, precipitated by some kind of violence in the corporate world. And he loses $300 million in basically 4 hours. And so he's like, you know, his whole dream of like kind of becoming a hotshot hedge fund guy comes crashing down. And he's basically certain that his boss is going to fire him. And instead, his boss, who's like politically connected and like a real sadist, says, actually, you're going to get that $300 million back in 3 months, or the government's looking at us for an insider trading investigation, and you're going to be our fall guy. And so that is kind of like the setup for the story. And Al is basically backed into a corner on, you know, chapter one, page one, and he needs to kind of figure out a way to get this $300 million back. And then because this is Wall Street and because it's a satire, he makes some increasingly ridiculous and amoral choices on his quest to get this money back. And it goes from there.
Yeah. So, you know, in addition to all the financial shenanigans that your main character gets up to, your book also dives pretty deep into like the financial world and uses a lot of financial lingo. But I really liked how you didn't spend too much time, you know, getting into the nitty gritty of how everything actually works. Like, for example, like what a derivative is. Can you talk about how you balanced telling a compelling financial story, especially for readers who may not be familiar with like those financial terms?
Yeah, no, it's a real challenge. And you have to make a decision about how much granularity and technical jargon you want to put in the novel and how much you can get away with so that where you don't lose the reader still, but you don't take them out of the story. And you know, if you read a lot of, you know, if you read a lot of like science fiction, or if you read like Michael Crichton books, you know, like they do a great job of giving you like a high level idea, but they don't really bog you down in details. And what I learned is that, you know, most of it is just kind of like hand waving, and you just kind of like, you get immersed in the story and you just go with it. But in order for me to write the book that I really wanted to and really analyze Wall Street and how grotesque some of the behavior is, and I wanted the reader to really understand, like, I didn't want to just wave it away and be like, hey, you know, I traded this stock and I made a 50% return. I wanted to really show people like how the nuts and bolts work, but also, you know, not bog them down in every single detail like you mentioned. And so one of the kind of craft decisions I made there was to put Al in the first person. And so then Al can then be explaining this kind of to himself while the reader gets to come along for the ride. And Al can also then be interrogating kind of how crazy some of the stuff that he does in his actual job, and then when he's doing things, you know, above board and doing things legally, versus then when he starts to do things that become, you know, illegal, and kind of juxtapose those together. And so I think, you know, it was an interesting challenge. And I do think I find a nice balance of letting people understand, like, this is actually more ridiculous than you think, but doing it in a way that was kind of funny and entertaining so that the reader didn't get lost. And even with that said, you know, some of the criticism you see from, like, you know, readers on Goodreads or whatever was that the jargon went over my head. But most people still say, even if the jargon went over their head, that they didn't get taken out of the story. And I think that was kind of the balancing act that you had to do, which is that, okay, maybe this is going to be something that people don't want to think about. Maybe their eyes glaze over when they hear something like, you know, a derivatives contract or short selling. But it's like, it's just brief enough that it doesn't take you out of the story. And at the end of the day, you're still interested in what's going to happen to Al. Is he going to get this money back? And then, you know, as you learn more about the character, you realize he's got even bigger problems, and how is he going to solve those?
Yeah, I think what really helps is, like you said, putting the book in first person, because you're not going to have your character explain all the financial terms when he already like knows what they are. And also just people's reactions to when the things happen in the market. And it's like, oh, okay, people are, you know, pretty much acting very abnormal, so I'm guessing that this is something that doesn't happen very often. And you know, I'm one of those readers who like I am not someone who is finance savvy, so I was like, oh, okay, like something bad happened, let's go. So I think you did a pretty good job balancing the terminology and also getting the plot moving forward without bogging everything down.
No, that's great to hear. And that was the goal, you know, was to kind of, what I learned from writing my first book was that, you know, novels are ultimately about characters. And so the reader has to be invested in Al, and Al just happens to navigate this crazy world of hedge funds and high finance. And so the world of Wall Street is ultimately the setting, right? It's not really the plot. And so Al and his actions drive the plot. And I think that I was able to kind of like marry those together and find the right balance. So that was great to hear that that struck the right chord for you guys.
Yeah. I mean, something I really like about like financial TV shows, like say Industry, right, is they create like high drama out of scenes where people are literally just looking at computer screens and talking in phones. And I definitely think your book captured like the high intensity of those scenes like really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the challenges that I had when I was looking for agents, actually, was positioning the book as a thriller when there's frankly, you know, there's economic violence, but there's not a lot of physical violence, right? Like, you know, a lot of people think thrillers, they think murder, they think some kind of crime. And so what's interesting is you have to keep the reader in suspense in a world where, like you said, you know, not a lot doesn't actually happen. Like, most people are just looking at their phone, looking at their computer screen. Like, it's kind of boring until you understand the context. And so it's the context that really drives the story. Like in the opening chapter when Al is talking to Jenny, and, you know, it's like he says that their whole fund is in the red, and you might not even know what that means if you're not familiar with Wall Street, or you don't, you know, look at your stock portfolio every day. But her reaction tells the reader, like, ooh, this is a catastrophe. Like, this doesn't happen at Prism, right? Like, this never happens to Al. And, like, you can get that, but I think, you know, it's very context dependent. And I've watched a little bit of industry, and I think they do a good job with that too. And of course, when you have a visual media, you know, the actors can really carry a lot of the weight for you with their facial expressions and with their tone of voice and things. And so when you put on the written page, you do have to find ways to be quite efficient.
So Al is very good, very competent at his job. He's like a top performer, and it's in an industry where nepotism is like very predominant. And despite this, he believes that he can get ahead by working hard. Like, he believes in meritocracy, and he believes that he got to where he was with all of his hard work and with his brains. But he kind of has a reality check when he comes into contact with insider trading and like the shadier sides of the business. Can you share your thoughts on, you know, the relationship that a lot of people of color have with the illusion of American meritocracy? Because I feel like this is something that a lot of us experience, especially when we are like college educated and we think that, you know, we've kind of achieved what our parents wanted us to achieve. And then the illusion just kind of breaks.
You know, there's kind of two ways I think about this. There's one is, you know, what I saw in my, you know, dealings in corporate America. And then there's two is, how do I experience it as a person of color? And in particular, me being a mixed race guy who, like Al in the story, again, his backstory is modeled off my backstory, where my dad is from Pakistan, but I never really met him. And so, you know, I'm a person of color, but I'm like, I grew up with white people and I thought I was like everyone else. And then, you know, you get to a certain point and you start navigating the world and you're like, oh, right, they don't treat me like everyone else. And in fact, they treat me with a lot of hostility quite often. And so the first lens to look at that through is just, I would say my entire professional trajectory, like starting all the way back in chemistry, I've basically been like the token minority guy, right? So I was in my chemistry lab down at the University of North Carolina. There was like, I don't know, 25 of us and maybe 2-3 people of color. And then, you know, and I'm the kind of token brown guy. And then you go to the pharmaceutical industry and you've got an organization that's just mostly, you know, white men and a few white women, and then some token people of color. And then I'm the token brown guy. And of course, and then in that pharmaceutical industry, in the chemistry department that I worked in, you know, there are only white men in the leadership positions. And this is in like kind of the mid to late 2010s. Then you go, and then I end up going to, you know, the investment bank. Now, interestingly, out in San Francisco, you've got some more diversity, and it's like not quite as like hostile as, like you say, a New York investment bank. It's not quite as like hard charging. But, you know, I worked with high intensity people and very competent people. But there are 9 senior analysts in our office, all white men. And then there are the kind of junior people are, we're the only place you'll find women and you'll find people of color. And then, of course, you'll find a little bit of an overlap there on the Venn diagram. And, you know, what happens is you just kind of see, like, you bump into that ceiling pretty quick that, like, you know, kind of the white guys are in charge and like they're not leaving anytime soon. And there's not going to be much of an opportunity for me to climb. And so that idea that, like, you know, well, if I just work extra hard, like I can go around them, it's like, that's just not how it's going to happen. and I saw that basically in every industry I've worked in. You know, just, I was just at BoucherCon, the great thriller and mystery writing conference, and I had a great time and everyone was really pleasant. But there was a debut author breakfast that I went to, and there were 34 debut authors. Now, this spans self-published, indie press, and Big Five. 34 debut authors. There were only 3 people of color, and I was the token brown guy. So, I mean, it's like, you know, this goes all the way back to, like, you know, 2003 until now, here we are in 2025, and I still am the token brown guy in, like, almost every environment that I go in. And so that's pretty disappointing, frankly. And then, you know, from the racial lens, you know, I, like I said, I mean, in a lot of ways, I never really thought of myself as Asian. So I'm happy to be on this podcast and I really appreciate you guys bringing me on. But like, I didn't really think of myself as Asian until I was like almost in my mid 30s when I really could kind of like, you know, contextualize it. Oh, right. Like Pakistan is in Asia. Like that was kind of a new insight for me, like as an adult, like, and because I growing up my whole life, like, you know, I didn't know anybody that was South Asian and I was in Miami. And so I was around a lot of, you know, Latino people, a lot of African-Americans or like, you know, Afro-Latino people. And so most of my lived experience, I kind of was kind of miscategorized as like a Hispanic guy or maybe like a half black guy or some kind of Creole or something. And so a lot of the racism that I've experienced in my life has people been treating me as Latino or black, actually, ironically, because South Asian representation wasn't very much in Florida when I was growing up. And so then I say that because, you know, I got into the corporate world, you realize like, man, there are like no Hispanic people. There are no black people. There are no Latino people, like men or women. And they're the token brown guys are all these South Asian guys. And so like, so it's like another kind of way that it's eye opening for me. So I don't know if that really got to the heart of your question, but that's kind of how I've experienced it.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think you answered the question quite well. And like, I actually thought there was a part in your book that I thought was pretty funny, but also it's kind of sad because it's pretty much real in real life. And that's when like we're introduced to the people who work under Al, and it's pretty much like all the token minorities. Like you have like the Asian girl, you have you have like a black guy, and it's just like, yeah, we're all in this together. And I'm like, I feel like that camaraderie is so real, but it's also so sad because there's like so little room to grow and to break that ceiling, like you said.
Yeah, no, it is. And I mean, those are things that are obviously drawn from my personal experience, like, you know, where it's like, oh, yeah, here's the token brown or black guy in any workplace you go to. And it's like, you know, you give the little head nod and you're like, oh, yeah, you know, I see you, like we're the same here. Like we're on the island. And so,
yeah, we have the nod. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and you can find solidarity with those people and, you know, and you can root for your friends even, or even if they're, you know, you're all competing to get ahead, like you can root for them and you can all then stand around and look at each other and be like, yeah, but we're not going anywhere, man. Like this is not how this game works.
Yeah. It's a really sad reality that I hope will change in the future, but I'm a cynic, so we'll see. Yeah. So Al's team at his hedge fund Vice, they profit off of companies that are actively making human lives worse. Like they invest in like companies that are like exacerbating like the opioid crisis and so on. So I would like to ask you, like, how does wealth influence morality in Al's life, and how does he kind of deal with that weight on his shoulders?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so Al is a cynic too. You know, if you read the prose, I mean, he's bordering on misanthropy, and so, you know, he's thinking like back to the kind of meritocratic idea. He's like, how can I get ahead? Well, I can come up with this fund that's so cynical and so nihilistic that if I just go for this, he calls it Vice, you know, like kind of like in LA Confidential, the Vice Squad kind of thing, right? Like how can I find the worst attributes and the worst behaviors displayed by humans and then profit off of that? And so that's obviously leans heavily into the kind of satirical element of the story. And so Al is basically thinking like, this is a way for me to get ahead. So I can do the meritocracy thing and I can make money and I can achieve prestige. And I think that ultimately, you know, starts that leads to his unraveling, you know, because he realizes as the story progresses that, like, you know, there's no amount of money that can make this moral or just or feel right and align with his values. And I think that that's definitely an auto-fictional aspect of the story, because when I was at the investment bank that I worked in San Francisco, I covered this sector called specialty pharmaceuticals, and I worked for the bank, so the hedge funds were our clients. And so we were called what's called the sell side, and the hedge funds and the institutional investors are what's called the buy side. And the buy side actually makes the investments and the sell side pitches the investments. And so we were covering these companies that did a lot of the things that Al talks about in the novel. Like, the companies that I covered were exacerbating the opioid crisis. Like, one of them was called Insys Therapeutics. The movie and book Pain Hustlers is based off of Insys. Insys went bankrupt. But we had a buy rating on that stock, and all these hot money hedge fund guys would come in, and they knew, everybody knew, man. Everybody knew that this company was not doing things above board, that this company was illegally marketing this drug, that they were exacerbating the opioid crisis. But that stock was on fire, man. And there was a return to be made, and I could generate alpha for my portfolio. And, you know, I took, you know, because this is my legal job requirement, I took the CEO on a roadshow to meet with like institutional investors. And like within a year, the guy's in federal prison, you know, like, I mean, you know, my compliance mandate was that I am an author, the junior analyst on this report that says buy the stock. So if I were to go tell people like, man, there's no way you can reliably invest in this, these guys are clearly criminals, then I would be breaking the law. Like, and so I would be violating my compliance mandate, and I could get fired for that, or even worse. And so, you know, it was like those kind of things that I saw in the hedge fund. I mean, the opioid crisis was by far the worst in the sector that we covered, called specialty pharmaceuticals. But there were companies doing blatant accounting fraud. There were companies that were price gouging, that were ripping off insurance companies, that were, you know, fleecing Medicare and Medicaid, that were gaming the PBM kind of pricing model. I mean, these guys were just, it was the Wild West. And so that really was an inspiration for how I thought about Al. And then thinking like, okay, what about like maybe a refracted version of me that's on the buy side of this hedge fund that's then trying to climb the ladder and trying to do the meritocracy thing and leaning into his like most nihilistic impulses. And that's kind of where the idea for Vice came. And I do think that ultimately, you know, Al finds the kind of, you know, character arc where he's just like, you know what, there's just, you couldn't give me enough money for me to think that this was the right thing to do.
Yeah. Actually, the Google, whether these funds exist in real life, and they do. And that was very like, it was an existential moment for him. I was like, oh man.
Yeah. And I think interestingly enough, and this is where the best part about writing fiction is that you don't have to get everything correct. A lot of these Vice funds don't perform that well, ironically. And that's, you know, most actively managed funds don't outperform your broader S&P 500. That's a known phenomenon in the hedge fund industry. The hedge fund industry is about taking your money and charging you a shit ton of fees, and then putting that money in our pocket, and then being like, hey, you know, we hedged you guys. We didn't make any actual money. You would have been better off buying a Vanguard ETF, but you were hedged. And like, that's kind of how the whole business model works. And so, but yeah, no, those Vice funds historically, at least as the data that I studied around that time, actually haven't performed as well as you might imagine, considering, you know, humanity's worst impulses.
Yeah. And it, you know, Al, because we're in his head for the book, we know that he grapples with a lot of insecurities, and also he has a suicidal ideation, and, you know, like, dark humor is dark humor. Like I cackled here and there because he was just like, oh my God, if I could just jump in front of a train right now, because my life has imploded. I'm like, same. I feel you. So like, why did you want to include that aspect of his personality into your book? And also, like, do you think Al's suicidal ideation and also his depression, do you think it's solely burnout, or do you think it's something deeper and something that is like actually like a mental illness that he just hasn't dealt with on his own?
Yeah, I mean, this is another place where I pulled some autofictional elements, and for a couple reasons. When I was younger, like in my early to mid 20s, like I grappled with depression like in a major way. Like, I was actually diagnosed with major clinical depression, and I was kind of consumed by thoughts of suicidal ideation for a significant portion of my life. You know, I never had a suicide attempt, luckily, and I think it was more of like a macabre fascination almost, just kind of like, you know, why am I here? And like, I think, you know, so a lot of that is derived from kind of lived experience, some of my own kind of like darkest thoughts, and infusing those into Al and then letting him run with them and see what he does. So like, I don't want to give the impression that Al and I are always thinking the same thing, but I thought, let me take some of my lived experience and infuse it into the character and then see what he does with it. And then, of course, you know, Al really leaned hard into kind of his satirical first person voice. And I think, you know, obviously they say writing funny is the hardest thing to do. well, writing funny about suicide has got to be the hardest thing to do. And I think I pulled it off because I think of the way that Al's narrative voice works. And so I think the kind of the way that it works in the narrative is at first you kind of dismiss it as like just kind of gallows humor. And I think that as the story progresses, you realize that Al is actually very troubled and he's got a lot of problems, and he becomes increasingly seeing suicide as a way out of this predicament. And so I think that's kind of part of his characterization. Now, you know, from a pure craft standpoint, again, not to be too cynical about it, but, you know, if it's just a bunch of money at risk on Wall Street, I don't think the stakes are that interesting. And so, like I said, I learned from writing my first book that didn't really go anywhere that, you know, novels are about characters and characters are about growth and about the stakes that they face. And so by also making Al have this kind of debilitating suicidal ideation and this kind of belief that there's always an exit path for him, you know, via taking his own life, the stakes literally become life and death. And then there's a mirror there because the stakes are life and death for Al personally, but then the stakes are life and death for society when these horrible companies and these grotesque hedge fund guys and these cynical Silicon Valley guys accumulate all the wealth and gut the government and, you know, make it so that you can't afford to eat, that you can't afford to pay your rent, that you can't afford to just basically survive in the country. Like, the stakes are life and death for real people while these horrible rich people, you know, are enriching themselves at everyone else's expense. And so I wanted to kind of mirror the internal stakes of Al with the external stakes in the real world. And I think if you just say, hey, you know, these guys are trading money and it's high pressure and it's like, it's kind of fun. It's like they're gambling against each other. It's like, no, man, like they're gambling against each other. But when the market crashes and people get laid off, and inflation goes high, like these are real consequences for real people in an everyday world, and the stakes become life and death for them. And I wanted that to be mirrored in the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of reminds me of, I forgot his name. I'm not a finance person, but like one of the people who bet on like the housing market crash in 2008, like they made like a shit ton of money. But then I heard that like all of their investments afterward were just fail after fail. And I'm like, oh, okay, so it is like gambling. Like, you can be as rational as possible and run the numbers, but doesn't mean that you're going to be lucky every single time. And I kind of saw that with Al, because it seems like he was on a roll with his hedge fund, but then just like one bad, like just a stroke of bad luck just kind of almost ended his career pretty much.
Right. And you know, at the end of the day, all of life adheres to a normal distribution, which is like, you know, you have a mean and then you have standard deviations. I know this is technical jargon, but, you know, most everything, basically everything in life fits that kind of bell curve. And so if you are, you know, way outside the bell curve to either direction, eventually you're going to regress to the mean. That's just math. Like, you cannot escape that. And so the hedge fund guys that make a great bet and maybe make a lot of money, and then they get lauded as like somehow they're just geniuses and they just have a preternatural understanding of the market. Well, they always regress to the mean because it's math. And like, no human is smarter than math. Math is just math. It doesn't care about how smart you are. It cares about doing what it does, which is just adhere to a normal distribution.
Yeah. And I think that's also like, you know, it goes with your narrative that like, in order to really truly make money, you have to cross that line, because the line of like insider trading is so opaque, right? How do you know when you got information? You know, like the speed of information is just, that's how this industry runs. And it's just like, at some point, you know, Al realizes that in order to truly make the returns that he needs to like placate his boss, he needs to cross that line and get into the world of things that aren't legal, but everyone's doing it.
Right, right. And the market is just based on human behavior. You know, you can have as sophisticated my financial model as you want. You can have all the algorithms and you can do all the Excel modeling in the world. But at the end of the day, the prices are driven by supply and demand, and supply and demand is driven by human behavior. And so it's an inherently uncertain and unpredictable business. And the only way to then beat that is to cheat. Like, just that, full stop. One of the things that the hedge funds, and again, I'm not a little bit out of the game, so don't, you know, quote me on this, but my understanding is a lot of what the hedge funds do nowadays is they've captured a lot of the trading volume that the investment banks used to do as the kind of broker-dealer part of the investment banking industry. So they just handle the trades that, you know, maybe you trade something in your 401k And then so some hedge fund will manage that trade for you, and then they'll just get in the middle and squeeze a little bit of the margin out. And so they don't even really bet on like fundamental stuff as much as they just kind of control trading volume, and they essentially become major brokers, and they use algorithms for that. And so I think that also speaks to the fact that they tried to beat the market and they couldn't, you know. And so they say they looked for a new business model that was more sure. And if people are going to trade all day long, then why not just basically get in the middle of the trade and siphon off a few cents at a time? And if you do that billions of times per day, then you got millions of dollars. So,
yeah, I'll also say like Al's initial predicament of losing 300 million in a way, the way you wrote it, the way that I read it too, is also like, it's kind of karmic, right? Because he lost money on betting high on payday loans or a payday loan broker, which is a company, like you mentioned, it's part of his vice fund, and it's a company that exploits people. And at some point people get tired of being exploited and fight back. And that's what causes his initial like fall. And I thought it was just really funny that, like, you know, he thinks it's the worst day of his life, it's bad luck, but it's also like you kind of deserved it in a way.
So many worse days for other people, like hundreds of thousands of people out there had worse days because of him. So yeah, like Marvin said, it's very karmic.
And yeah, I just want to, like, you know, finance stories are always interesting because like you have to root for your main character, but the main characters are usually like capitalists and people who are complicit in the system. So can you talk a little bit how you kind of thread that needle of, you know, writing a like a financier, but also making them, you know, relatable? And how did you employ any strategies to like kind of make sure that the readers did root for him?
Yeah, no, it's tricky because I think some of the funnier feedback I've seen, you know, is like, and even from like, you know, like a trade journal, Publishers Weekly, you know, had a pretty good review, but they said like, you'll reluctantly root for, you know, Al. And I'm like, that's interesting. You know, I'm rooting for Al. You know, when I write the book, I'm rooting for Al. I think Al, you know, I'd hate to make everything about like race and, you know, and minorities versus, you know, essentially, you know, white supremacy effectively. Right. But I mean, I think the book would not be anywhere near as compelling if the guy was a white guy that was the Nepo baby. Right. I'm just candidly, right, if we're being honest here, because I think people are gonna have a hard time empathizing with a character that comes from privilege, was experiencing privilege, and then like, oh wow, you know, I had a bad day in the market. It's like, I just think it's really going to be hard to feel empathy for that person. And so with Al, given his kind of like tragic backstory, like right off the bat, you're like, okay, he's the underdog. So I think that really helps his character be relatable, because he's like, you know, a lot of people that have, you know, regular people, quote unquote, that are nowhere near getting an opportunity to work in these kind of major elite institutions and make big money, it's easy to criticize from the sideline. But if you had a chance to work in a prestigious hedge fund and get a big paycheck, like how many people would say no? Right. And so that's what we have to be realistic about. I mean, we're in a capitalist system, and it's definitely exploitative, and it's definitely unfair, and it's definitely inequitable. And so, but it's not going to change anytime soon, at least as far as we can tell. So if you get a chance to get in the game, like, what are you going to do? Like, on your principles, say no. And so I think people can instantly see that, okay, Al's one of the kind of guys like us, like he made it. And so, and then he still got hosed. And so I think you automatically feel kind of bad for him. Like, well, maybe he can still make it. He can represent us, if you will. And I think that helps. And then I do think that, one of the things that I try to be cautious about is that, you know, I'm obviously extremely critical of capitalism, and I'm cautious to say that I don't necessarily think that capitalism is intrinsically bad. It's a system designed by humans and run by humans. If we run it the way we're running it now, it's definitely not working. If you ran it the way it was kind of post New Deal, with like much different tax rates and a much bigger social safety net, or if the way they do it in Europe, I mean, Europe is not a social, no countries in Europe are socialist. They're capital markets with a much bigger safety net. And so they're doing capitalism just with a much different kind of tax regime and a different kind of state level, participation in the market. It's still capitalism. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that and a lot of culture war crap. And so the other thing I would say is just, you know, like Al, you know, I worked in pharmaceutical companies and I worked in investment banks, and a lot of people are good people, actually. Like, a lot of people are nice. Like, most people are intrinsically decent people. And a lot of people, when you get in these big corporate environments and you're working for a pharmaceutical company and you're like, why are we charging $150,000 for this treatment? It doesn't make any sense. Like, these people are having those conversations inside the building. Like, they don't feel good about it. But then it's like, what's their alternative? Like, quit in protest and then not be able to support their own family? And so there are a lot of people that are conflicted in these organizations, and there are a lot of people that have good values that ultimately end up in institutions that have bad values. And I think that that's another thing that you can see with Al, is that even if you don't like his sense of humor, even if you think maybe he's gross or whatever, or he's, you know, got some personality flaws, with which he certainly does, you know, he's ultimately a good person. And I think that's what helps you kind of get behind him, even though he's, you know, in this world of awful people.
Speaking of good person and awful people, is there a side character that is like a favorite of yours, even if they're bad, even if they're awful?
Yeah, I think I did a good job rendering all the characters in three dimensions. Like I don't think any of the characters are flat. Even Karen, our token, you know, social media star who behaves like a Karen, is named Karen. I mean, she's still pretty interesting, and she's got some complexity and more layers than I think you might originally assume. But I mean, I think if we're talking about all the characters in the book, I mean, Damon's got to be, you know, my favorite character aside from Al, right? I mean, because he's Al's boy, and he's kind of going through what Al does. You know, he's in a big institution. He's the token minority. He's kind of like, you know, thinking he's sort of trying to do the meritocracy thing. And he's, you know, they're running into all the same walls that Al does. And I think, you know, Damon ultimately kind of kicks the story off, you know, when he kind of puts him on the path, when he puts Al on the path to eventually go kind of into the financial underworld. And so I think Damon is an interesting character because he's not cookie cutter either. Like he ultimately gives Al the first tip that sends him down this, you know, path of no return, but he's ultimately a good dude and he cares about Al and he wants to support Al. And so I like Damon a lot, but I do think, you know, even Brad, who is like reprehensible villain, you know, I mean, I think he's funny. I think the jokes he makes are offensive, obviously, but I laugh. I mean, I wrote them. I thought they were funny. I think you're supposed to laugh at them. I know, like, we're in a very delicate, you know, we want to be careful about, like, you know, not offending people and, like, you know, and not, you know, alienating people. But like, the jokes are pretty funny. I think you have to laugh at it, because if you take it so seriously, then it gives it power. And like, you have to laugh it off and kind of like lean into the absurdity of it all to kind of like, you know, take the power away. And I think that's part of what I'm hoping to try to do there with Brad as a character. And then, you know, looking at his character arc as well, you know, I don't want to spoil the story for anybody, but he undergoes quite a bit of change and growth as the story goes on. And so I think, you know, all these characters really bring something to the table and I think I try to render them as complex and morally gray as anybody who works in a hedge fund or a big law firm would be.
Yeah, a toxic swamp. So it's hard to be a good person in an environment like that, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, it's satire and it feels like satire, but also feels really close to truth. Like, I still remember one of my first internships in college was at like a wealth management firm. And I just remember being kind of taken aback by how bro-y everyone in that office was. Like, every weekend was about like chicks and stuff.
It's like,
and
it was like toxic heterosexuality, and it's just like, why? Who are you trying to impress? Other men, probably. But
yeah, no, and the whole industry and most of corporate America, especially from the male macho side of it, is just rooted in a deep insecurity. I mean, these guys are all just trying to make money to convince themselves that they have intrinsic value, and the reality is, you know, every human being has intrinsic value, even if they do bad things. And in order to convince yourself that you have intrinsic value, you have to look inward and find your intrinsic value. Like, nothing externally is ever going to make you feel like you're worth it or you're a good person. Like, you have to look inward and decide for yourself. And then that has something to do with how much money you make.
Yeah. It's a lesson that a lot of people in their 20s don't figure out. I figured like once they hit the midlife crisis, that's when they start questioning those things. But I digress. We are winding down to our end of our time. We had such a great discussion. I know your book came out in August, so it's been some time now. How has the book tour been going for you?
Yeah. We had a lot of nice publicity right at the launch. So People Magazine featured the book as like its top book of August, and it was the book of the week. So that was really neat. So I was like, my picture and the book is in People Magazine. So that was really cool. And it had some nice pub. Chicago Magazine covered it. It got a starred review in Booklist. And then I was big in the newsletter ecosystem on Substack for a while. I'm no longer on Substack, but I knew a lot of people there, so I was able to kind of drum up some coverage that way. And so it's kind of like the book trafficked a little bit on Substack. I've done a couple podcasts and luckily, you know, feel very fortunate to talk to you guys here. And so, you know, so the publicity wise, I think the book did quite well. In terms of the tour, you know, we didn't actually go on a tour. Big publishers have kind of done the math and figured out that, you know, book tours don't really return on the investment, especially when you're a new author. Like, you know, you send this poor debut author on the road and they go to stores and then there's nobody there and they don't sell any copies. And it's kind of depressing for everybody. And it also costs money. And so I think what you're seeing more these days is book tours are more for like established mid-list authors or like big authors whose book is already taken off. And then it's like, we can then go on a tour to kind of run the score up. And so for me, I only did a local event here in Chicago, but we packed the house and then we had a lot of fun. And, you know, I think at this point, I'm just trying to stay sane in an industry that will drive you inherently insane. And I'm just like hoping that the book kind of gets that slow burn uptick word of mouth, because that's ultimately what makes any book successful. You know, we didn't hit any bestseller lists and that didn't surprise anyone because it's really hard. And, but the book is getting good reviews on Goodreads. It had nice publicity. It's got some nice word of mouth. And so I just hope, you know, it just kind of finds its way into people's hands over time and maybe becomes something that is like, hey man, you got to read this book. Eventually the market's going to crash and see me disaster. And I think people are going to be like, hey man, did you ever hear about this book Leverage? Like, you should check this out.
So, yeah. That AI bubble is really, really getting big there.
Real big.
So before we go, are you working on anything else right now?
Yeah. So my first book with Leverage, it came out with Atria. And so Atria is per standard publishing contract. They have a writer first refusal. And so I have a partial draft for a novel that's another kind of contemporary satire. There's a financial angle to it, but it's not in the world of hedge funds or anything like that. It's actually in the world of reality TV. And so I wanted to kind of, you know, do something a little different, but that's still kind of, it plays in my lane. And so I have that book. It's about 12,000 words and I had a full outline. And that's with Atria. And so I'm hoping that they want to take a stab at that one as well. And then, you know, sign me up for book number two. If not, then, you know, that's the game. And I'll just write the book. And then my agent and I will look for whoever else might be interested in. So yeah, but I love writing. It's something that I found kind of late in life. And I hope to be doing this for basically the rest of my life. I think this is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your debut. And yeah, good luck on that second book. And it's always harder to write the next one to keep
going. The sophomore
going.
Slump.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's definitely a sophomore slump involved. So I'm just trying to kind of fight through that and keep this thing rolling.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for the congratulations and for having me on the show.
And that was Amran Gowani. His debut novel, Leverage, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba bookshop. So if you enjoyed our conversation and are interested in picking up the book, head on over to booksandboba.com and check out our bookshop link. And as always, all purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So we definitely appreciate everyone's bought a book from us so far. Yeah, I guess before we call it an episode, Reba, can you please remind us what book we are reading for book club this September 2025?
So September was my month to pick, and my pick was A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping by Sangu Mandana. And we had Sangu back more than a year ago, and we talked to her about her book, The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, which takes place in the same universe as A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping. And it is about a witch who is kind of exiled from her magical society and runs an inn and befriends a semi-villainous talking fox. It's supposed to be cozy. It is September. It is the burr seasons, meaning it's time for whimsy. It's time for coziness. So yeah, I'm very excited to talk about this book with you all. I know some of you have already finished the book because it's just one of those genres that you just, you know, binge read in one sitting because you're so comfortable and you're so cozy.
Yeah, our book club members have definitely been enjoying the vibes. So looking forward to a very vibey book club discussion with you, Reba, at the end of the month. As always, we are doing a read-along on Discord. So if you are a Patreon supporter, don't forget to participate in our discussion. And for those of you not on our Discord, you can also give us your thoughts about the book on our Goodreads forums. As always, we'd love to include your feedback on our book club discussion episodes whenever possible. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Amran Gowani for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Reira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue.
follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandvulva and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandvulva.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Vulva and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandvulva.com. Books and Vulva is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
The Korean Drama Podcast is back for our sixth season.
The Korean Drama Podcast is the podcast about watching Korean dramas by people who don't watch Korean dramas. Hosted by Candace, Jane, and me, Kim.
Wait, if it's our sixth season, can we still say we're people who don't watch Korean dramas?
I'm sure it's fine. Let's just call it character development, which we love in K-dramas.
For our new season, we're recapping the hit 2025 romantic fantasy series Heavenly Ever After, about an elderly couple who reunite in the afterlife. Only he's now in his 30s while she's chosen to appear in her 80s.
Awkward.
So join us each week as we discuss the highs and lows of the afterlife in Heavenly Ever After, episode by episode.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.